Hello, I'm Paul Letters, historian, novelist, and radio broadcaster. Thanks for joining us for This Month in History, brought to you by Noreen Meir and RTHK Radio 3. For more history podcasts, plus my World War II novel, A Chance Kill, please see paulletters.com.
Right, welcome back to the 1-2-3 show with me, Noreen Meir, and Paul Letters this Thursday afternoon. The time is 1:23. 1-2-3. Paul, welcome back on the show. How have you been?
I've been good, thanks. Thanks for having me back.
You're looking very smart today.
Yeah, well, straight from my day job and my other job.
And afterwards you have to rush back.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Busy man. Yeah. So I understand you prepared a question for our listeners.
Yeah, that's right. What do you think came first, the world's first television broadcast or the first passenger flights between Asia and America?
Oh, that's a tough one. I'm really not sure. Okay, the world's first television broadcast or the first flights between Asia and America?
It is a close call, actually.
Oh, is it? Oh, okay, that's good. Well, if you want to weigh in on it, the listeners, do write in 123show@rthk.hk. And we're open for these sort of communication. Also on the Facebook page, Noreen Meir on RTHK Radio 3, as well as Paul's Facebook page as well. If you're his friend, you can also...
Yeah, way in there, that's
way
good.
Way in there as well. All right then, Paul, let me hand it over to you.
Well, Noreen, you remember history at school? Do you remember studying World War II? And do you remember being how it was World War II was the UK and China versus Germany, Italy, Japan, Spain and the Soviet Union?
No, not really.
Well, we'll be looking into that. It almost was. It would have been interesting one, particularly the Soviet Union on Germany's side. So, yeah, this is November 1940, and Hitler is aiming to extend the what was called the Tripartite Pact, because it was Germany, Japan and Italy. And he was inviting the USSR to join them. And so, yeah, it was November 1940 was a really big month in this regard, because it's when the Tripartite Pact went from being three members to eight. So we tend to call it the Axis powers from that point, because it's obviously not the tri anymore.
No.
So, yeah, 4 years earlier in November, on November 25th, 1936, the Nazi Germany and Imperial Japan signed the Anti-Comintern Pact, a sort of anti-communist agreement to stop the spread of communism. So it seemed, you can imagine from communist Soviet Union's point of view, that now 4 years later in 1940, they're being invited to join an anti-communist alliance. So, yeah, it was an interesting one. So the German foreign minister Ribbentrop invited the Soviet foreign minister Molotov to visit Berlin to hear this proposal. And this, of course, is 1940. This is a time when the USA was neutral. So it really would have been so loaded on Germany's side if USSR had gone in that direction. But to understand what tempted the USSR to join the Nazis in an unlikely alliance, perhaps, in November 1940, we need to look at the pact that they already had between Nazi Germany and the Soviet Union. Remember, in August 1939, Ribbentrop and Molotov had put together the Nazi-Soviet pact. So the home of communism had already made this deal with their bitter fascist enemies in Germany. But that deal was coming under strain by the autumn of 1940. The Nazi-Soviet pact had been about these two superpowers avoiding war with each other. And, of course, in that pact, they divided up Poland between them. But also at the heart of the pact was a trade relationship between the Soviet Union and Germany. And the USSR was supplying Germany, still now in November 1940, with raw materials like oil and metals, which helped, obviously, in Germany's kind of conquering of Europe, its war machine. And German expertise used those materials to make machines that would make guns and shells and so on, as well as making tanks and ships. And some of that military hardware was traded back to the USSR. So the Soviet Union was saying, we'll give you the raw materials if you give some of it back to us in terms of
machines.
Yeah, finished product.
Did they have a friendship sort of prior to this then?
No, quite well. prior to August.
Very unlikely.
No, quite the opposite. Until August 1939, both countries' propaganda machines were saying how much they hated the other side and blaming everything on them. This is, of course, they're still neutral between each other. But then in August 1939, before war breaks out in Europe, they sign this Nazi-Soviet pact. So they have to completely backtrack on their propaganda and rewrite their recent kind of history, and the newspapers in both countries are directed to be nice to the other country now.
I suppose they both had the US as their common enemy.
Yes,
as well.
Exactly what happened. They both decided to point their propaganda against the US, and Britain actually probably got even more at that particular time, sort of standing as it was more geographically in Hitler's way, at least, than the US was. So it was a very kind of interesting relationship they had. Germany supplying the USSR with things that would one day be used against Germany, and Russia was supplying Germany with raw materials like oil, which would one day literally fuel a German invasion of the Soviet Union. That doesn't come till 1941. And if Hitler's plan had worked here in November 1940... I don't know. You know, history could have been very, very different indeed. Yeah. Imagine a Nazi-Soviet war alliance. And it wasn't so far away. There were cracks appearing in that relationship by autumn 1940, and that kind of is maybe why Ribbentrop invited Molotov to Berlin specifically at this time. Some of the supply of these raw materials and armaments has sort of dripped through recently. You could tell both sides wasn't really wanting to help out the other. So they met in the middle of November, 12th of November in 1940 in Berlin. Ribbentrop as host. He liked to think of himself as the ultimate host and an outgoing kind of gregarious guy. He'd been ambassador in the UK before the war, and he didn't pull it off as far as the UK sort of establishment was concerned. They just thought he was a sort of boorish oaf, generally. But there he was trying to charm Molotov. Now, Molotov, you'll love his nickname. Molotov considered politeness a complete waste of time and waste of effort. He was a hard-nosed negotiator, and he had the nickname Stone Arse. If I'm allowed to say that on daytime radio.
Yeah, absolutely. I liked his name Molotov already, but Stone Arse.
Yeah, of course, our listeners may well know lots about him, but one thing that you probably know is the Molotov cocktail, the sort of homemade grenade, get some sort of flammable liquid in a bottle. And a bit of rag in the top and light it and throw it. And that's what Finland had been fighting against the USSR in 1939 up to spring 1940. And that's where they came up with that name.
I'm quite surprised because being the foreign minister, Molotov, I would think he had some sort of charisma of some sort and not such a sort
yeah,
of...
Yeah, I suppose it's, you know, in a democratic state, you'd certainly have to have. But and sometimes in non-democratic states, like Ribbentrop had in Germany, but really the most important thing here is that you had to be liked by Stalin.
That's the prerequisite.
Yeah, and not killed by Stalin, because there's plenty of people he likes and then obviously later turns on. So if you've survived to 1940, you're probably relatively trusted.
So was Molotov charmed by Ribbentrop?
That's right. He wasn't letting on that he had a poker face, you know, and so Ribbentrop was trying to give him this hard sell, really. Ribbentrop's proclaiming by November 1940, England's beaten, Germany is extraordinarily strong, the USA, of course, is out of it geographically and you know, is neutral, and the tripartite powers, Germany, Italy, Japan, they're not considering how they might possibly win the war. They're looking at rather how rapidly they can end the war that they'd already won. That was Ribbentrop's words. And then that Germany, Italy, Japan would divide up the French and British empires, and Ribbentrop says to Molotov, and the USSR should join them. Come and get a bit of the bounty. Molotov did ask one or two questions. He asked about Japan's new phrase that had been coming to prominence, the Greater East Asian Sphere, sometimes the co-prosperity spheres added to that. obviously Russia was concerned about the limits of geographical limits of where Japan might go in Asia, obviously bordering the Soviet Union. But Ribbentrop said he knew nothing about Japan's intentions there. But he did know that Japan was keen to achieve a broad understanding, he said, with the USSR. And that's one thing which would have appealed to Stalin, seeking to stay out of World War II. And he already had a neutrality agreement with Japan after a brief border war a year or so earlier. So he was clearly, he had the opportunity to launch into a full war against Japan, but didn't take it and wouldn't take it until 1945 after the atomic bombs dropped. So Ribbentrop dangles the membership of the tripartite pact in front of Molotov, but then Molotov's taken to see Hitler. And so there in Hitler's vast office, it was more like a banqueting hall than an office. You know, it would take you, I don't know how long, to when you enter the door to actually get through and to Hitler's desk at the far end. And of course, Hitler didn't stand up at first. He would just wait for Molotov to come right up to the desk, finish off whatever he's writing, then stand up and greet him. And
wow.
This is after going past the parades of the SS officers, of course, and it all put on for a show and an intimidation just to get into the office. But then things began to turn in this meeting. Immediately, Molotov fired questions at Hitler. You don't fire questions at Hitler.
No,
but Molotov,
because he'll fire
did.
You.
Exactly. Yeah, he just kept firing questions about the origins of the Tripartite Pact, remembering it had begun in 1936 as an anti-communist alliance against the Soviet Union. So Molotov's asking Hitler, how could the Soviet Union fit into this? And also he asked, well, what about Southeast Europe, the Balkans area, the Black Sea? That's where the Soviet Union wanted land and influence around Bulgaria and so on. And Hitler was not wanting to make any commitments there. So Molotov just launched from one question to another. But when eventually Hitler did get to speak, Hitler focused on again, the French and British empires and dividing that up together with most of the rest of the world between Germany, Italy, Japan and the USSR. And the Nazi plan was that those four powers would each work southwards. So they had this idea that Germany, Italy, Japan and USSR won't get in each other's way if they go south, because obviously they're kind of east to west, generally speaking, of each other. So they would avoid a clash. Italy would get North and East Africa, where it was already involved in Abyssinia, today Ethiopia. Japan would get the China Seas and the whole Western Pacific, really. And Germany, who already had most of Europe, of course, would take Central Africa. And the USSR could push south to the Persian Gulf and Indian Ocean and take over the British Empire in India.
Okay. Paul, can I ask, did Germany genuinely want Russia? Did they genuinely want USSR to join the pact? Because, well, you being a historian, and I do want to ask you this question, because
yeah.
I've also read somewhere that because in July, we're talking right now, November 1940.
Right.
But then in July 1940, so back 4 months ago, just weeks after the defeat of France, Hitler decided that Nazi Germany would actually launch an attack to USSR the following spring. So this is slap bang in the middle in November. So were they still planning that attack?
They were planning all the way through to attack the USSR.
They were trying to trick them then.
Yeah, I would say so. But there's always that possibility, though, that we don't know. If the USSR had joined in alliance with Germany, and Germany could have sort of defeated all of its other enemies first and then taken on the USSR, and it would have been a different ball game. As it was, when they end up invading the USSR, they've got Britain on one side of them. A few months later, the USA comes into the war. But we've also got to remember, although I don't think it's an overriding factor in this case, but all the time, today and in history, governments are planning military scenarios that don't happen. The vast, vast majority of them, they don't go through. And there may even where it includes plans for being the aggressor at times. So we can't state as a fact, mm-hmm. you know. But certainly he had names. Even when he wrote Mein Kampf in 1924, yeah, he'd named the USSR as his sort of ultimate enemy.
I've read about a quarter of that book.
Done well. It's a hard read, isn't
it? I don't know why. I was going through my phase of history. So.
Yeah, I decided when I was studying A-level history that I should read Mein Kampf.
But, did you read it?
I now advise my students your time will be so much better spent reading, because you could read about 10 other books in the same amount of time.
It's not even a readable book. No. I think it's kind of like squeezing toothpaste. Yes. You just read a little bit by little bit.
Yeah, painful work. Yeah, so this was the deal put forward. Molotov, again, didn't give much away, but he said he would discuss it with Stalin, but there was still a stony atmosphere there. But that evening, the atmosphere between the German and Soviet delegations did become more convivial. A farewell reception for the Soviets held at the Soviet embassy in Berlin, and Russian produce like vodka and caviar, as you'd expect, was laid out in abundance. And Molotov proposed a toast to his German counterpart Ribbentrop, the German foreign minister. But just at that moment, when Molotov proposed the toast, some unexpected guests crashed the party. Britain's Royal Air Force. The British had deliberately planned a raid on Berlin for that night, knowing Molotov was there, to press home to Molotov that Britain was still very much in the fight. And Churchill later joked that, though not invited to join in the discussion, I did not wish to be entirely left out of proceedings. So the air raid sirens in Berlin are wailing, and the two foreign ministers scurry into the air raid shelter, where Ribbentrop's repeated claims that the British were finished kind of echo to the backdrop of these RAF bombs pummeling Berlin. And Molotov was a realist, and Molotov and Stalin were very kind of cautious. So the reality of the situation wasn't lost on Molotov. Of course, there were a lot of kind of unanswered questions when he would take that deal back to Stalin, and the Soviet interests, such as the Black Sea and the Balkans. There were no commitments there from Nazi Germany. They couldn't be confident about getting what they wanted, and Japan was already making kind of military aggressive moves against Soviet interests on that side of the world. So that deal, you know, obviously never came off. But it's an interesting what if kind of question that you could have got the USSR joining Germany in war. But what did happen in November 1940, tomorrow, 20th of November, Hungary joined the Tripartite Pact, the Axis powers. Then on the 23rd of November, Romania signed the same deal. And on the 24th, Slovakia joined. And then in March 1941, Bulgaria and Yugoslavia joined. So it's still referred to as the Tripartite Pact, but by then it's got 8 members. But thankfully, not the USSR. Otherwise, the world might be a very different place, I'd guess, today.
Yeah. All right, let's take a quick trailer break, and we'll return to more This Month in History with Paul Letters. Welcome back to the 1-2-3 show with me, Noreen Mir, and Paul Letters. Before we talk more about This Month in History, quickly, we're asking this question. What do you think came first, the world's first television broadcast or the first passenger flights between Asia and America? The first flights between Asia and America or the first the world's first television broadcast? If you think you have an answer to that, or if you care to venture a guess, you can email us at 123show@rthk.hk or get in touch on the Facebook page, Noreen Mir on RTHK Radio 3. Right, Paul, from Germany and USSR, we head to Spain.
Yeah, we're staying in November 1940. Hitler's urging Spain to grab Gibraltar, which General Franco, the fascist leader of Spain, of course, had his eyes on for some time. And Hitler's also saying to Spain to join the Tripartite Pact and get involved in World War II. So he tells, increasingly Hitler's kind of increasing the pressure through October and then November 1940, and he tells Spain they must come through on an agreement they'd already made to attack Gibraltar, which, of course, is this British-controlled peninsula at the southern tip of Spain, and very close, of course, to the North Africa, which Gibraltar guards the entrance to the Mediterranean. So from the Atlantic, it's the only way in to the Mediterranean. So if you've got control there, then you can really kind of control who comes ships-wise, who comes in and out of the Mediterranean. And it would have cut off the British troops who were in North Africa fighting against the Italians there. It would have cut off supplies to them. Hitler and Franco had met in France a few weeks earlier to fix the deals of this alliance. So certainly Hitler's under the impression it's just about to happen. But of course, Spain had just emerged from a civil war from 1936 to 1939. And although that's what got Franco into power, it's clearly an exhausted country, and Franco knows it.
Was Gibraltar part of Britain?
Yeah,
then?
Been part of Britain for since 1704. Spain lost it in the War of Spanish Succession in 1704.
Yeah.
Yes, obviously before that, Spain has a very good claim on Gibraltar. And it's still an issue today. It's still a bone of contention, although generally the Spanish and British governments get on well. Spain, understandably, wonders why this foreign power has this kind of a tip of land, of which before 1704 belonged to Spain.
Is it still part of British rule?
Still British, yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, still British to this day. So, Franco organised frenzied mobs to demand war against England to retake Gibraltar. So, on the one hand, Franco is making certain moves, which obviously Hitler likes as well. Hitler's making his demands also for Spain to allow several divisions, tens of thousands of German troops, to travel through Spain to attack Gibraltar, particularly if Spain won't do it itself. But of course, Spain is neutral, and if it's neutral and allows German troops to come through, then it's not neutral any longer. And Franco's got certain concerns that we'll get into. So he refused to Hitler's request there, saying that the United Kingdom still presented a danger to Spain and Spanish colonies around the world. And Franco told Hitler he wanted to wait until Britain was on the point of collapse. Gibraltar, very strategic region, as we've said. It would stop any future British plans to invade Italy, which is what they end up doing in 1943, from Africa and jumping across. That would certainly stop, or at least make that very difficult for Britain if Britain no longer had control of the gateway into the Mediterranean. But again, Franco's dithering throughout the whole process. He did allow German submarines to refuel in Spanish ports, and he allowed and encouraged and helped German spies in Spain to keep tabs on British naval forces in Gibraltar, and was passing information Germany's way. But he's also getting supplies, because Spain's neutral, from some of the Allies, including oil from the US, and the US are kind of working with Britain. And the US, of course, are neutral in inverted commas, just like Spain is neutral, but of course the US is leaning towards Britain and is kind of asking Britain, should we be selling oil and so on, and Britain's concerned if they stop the supply of oil, then Franco will turn to Germany for that, for that supply. So it's a, it's a delicate kind of balance of a game. Of course, in the end, Spain does not join the tripartite powers, the Axis powers, and remains neutral, and therefore when the fascists lose, Franco is still dictator until 1975. In fact, it's November 1975, 22nd, when King Juan Carlos was sworn in Spain following the death of Franco. So, fascism we often think is a World War II thing, but obviously not entirely.
Did Hitler and Franco get along then?
Well,
because there was Hitler urging them to reclaim Gibraltar, but did they like each other, or was it just another ploy so that they could get Gibraltar off Spain afterwards?
Well, kind of yes and no. I think at first they got along, but soon, certainly from Hitler's point of view, as Franco was dithering and Hitler felt like he couldn't trust him, he refers to, when he talks to Mussolini after meeting Franco and realising Franco's letting him down, Hitler refers to Franco in the most sort of disparaging terms.
Didn't he say this to Mussolini as well?
That's right, yeah. I prefer to have three or four of my own teeth pulled out than to speak to that man again. That's Hitler talking about Franco, but talking to Mussolini.
So oh, yeah, then I don't think he liked him too much if he'd rather pull out his own teeth. Right, Paul, we're just coming up to 10 minutes before the 2 o'clock news. I know you've got to head back to teach, but before you go, can you reveal the question? I mean, the answer, but what's the question again?
Yeah, so we were asking about what came first, the world's first television broadcast or the first passenger flights between Asia and America.
I have a couple of answers here, but by email, 123show@rthk.hk. Carol writes in to say, I think it's flights. Jenny also writes in and she says, I think flights as well. Terry says, I believe it's TV. Maybe if I can venture a guess.
Go on.
I think it's the TV. I think
you
it's
TV the TV.
Because I'll tell you why. Because I once interviewed Rachel Cartland, a former government official, and she came to Hong Kong in the 70s, and she said she came here by boat. So there mustn't be flights between. I don't know. Yeah. I don't know why that really stuck in my head. I'm sorry, Rachel, if you're listening, I really remembered your backstory. So I'm guessing TV.
Well, 2nd of November 1936, BBC Television launched the world's first regular high definition, and yes, that's what they called that blurry black and white image.
High definition.
Exactly. It's remarkable that we somehow that term is used today as to market in sort of marketing these new TVs.
It was already used in the 30s.
Yes. And they had 240 lines on a screen back then, and I think now high definition, not ultra high definition, but high definition now has 1,080 lines. So obviously things have moved along. But that was 2nd of November 1936 with a 2-hour sort of concert and variety show on BBC TV. Now the flight, there's a couple of stages to this. On November 22nd, 1935, airmail service begins. The China Clipper, a Pan American flying boat, took off from San Francisco, reaching the Philippines 59 hours later. But of course, that's not a passenger flight yet. But then over the following year, the route is finally made ready for passenger service. They had to make sure that, for example, there was accommodation for the passengers to stop at on some of the stopping points where they would refuel and rest, Hawaii and so on. And so by November 1936, we get the first passenger flights between Asia and America. By October, the end of October 1936, so it happens just before we get TV on November 2nd, 1936. So the flights win, but really just by about a week. And among the crew on the first passenger flight was Fred Noonan, who was one of the best navigators of his day, and he would later accompany Amelia Earhart on her round the world flight in 1937. The flight that never returned. The aircraft went missing in the South Pacific.
Maybe she's still alive. Shall we end on this note?
Thank you for listening. For links on today's topics, plus free chapters from my novel, visit paulletters.com, where you'll also find my daily updates for On This Day in World War II and lots more free content.